This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Election College, episode 256, Grover Cleveland, part one.
Let's throw a political party. Face it, the political scene sucks, but did it always? It's time for Election College, and class is in session. Now, your hosts, Jason Goff and Ben Smith.
Hey, Ben, if your name is Steven and your middle name is Grover, well, my goodness, you're going to want to go by Grover. And that's exactly the type of man Steven Grover Cleveland was, because this guy, he could grow a nice mustache and he could really carry the Grover moniker very well.
Man, I know I'm getting way off topic really early in this episode, but you talk about a mustache. I think about all the presidents that we've commented and all the historical figures in general. We've talked about their facial hair. I saw a picture today, I think it was, on some social networking site, and it was President Obama with a beard. And I don't know if it was a legit picture? Does he actually have a beard?
I don't know. I'm going to Google that right now.
I don't know, but I tell you what, President Obama with a beard, whether you like the guy or not, he rocks a good beard, and I just wasn't expecting it. And if it's not a real picture, whoever photoshopped it did an awesome job.
Oh, it's fake.
Well, that's fine with me. I think you should take it as inspiration and grow a beard.
You think so?
I'm going to write him and suggest it.
Get okay. On Twitter. Yeah. You do that. I'm sure he's listening.
Yeah, probably, yeah. Anyway, Grover Cleveland's dad was a minister, and he was from Connecticut. He was part of the Congregational and Presbyterian churches at different times. His mother was from Baltimore, and her father had previously been a bookseller before that. And they were, he was kind of a mixed family as far as his descent. His father was descended from English ancestors, and they had come to Massachusetts from Cleveland, England, which, you know, maybe that has something to do with his name, maybe it doesn't, back in 1635. His father's grandfather on his mother's side had fought at the Battle of Bunker Hill and was also the son of an immigrant. So lots of stuff going on dad's side. On mom's side, he was a descendant of some Anglo-Irish Protestants and some German Quakers. So he's distantly related to
everyone.
Moses Cleveland. Yeah, everyone. But the guy who Cleveland, Ohio was named after, he's related to them too. So there you go. He's got a lot of connections.
Yeah. And Cleveland is the fifth of nine children. So don't be thinking that if you're a middle child that you can't go out and do amazing things, because nine kids, it's a lot of kids. And when you're number five, you probably get overlooked a little bit.
Probably.
Overlooked to the point to where when you're born, they're like, what are you going to name this kid? And they're scrambling and they're thinking, let's name him after the first pastor of the church where the dad is the preacher, right? So they're like, okay, what was the name of the first pastor of this place? And they're like, Stephen Grover. Sounds good.
Yeah.
That probably isn't the case. I'm sure they were extremely happy to have this young, beautiful baby born into their house. It's number five. He might become desensitized a little bit. Anyway, like a lot of middle children, neighbors described him as being, quote, full of fun and inclined to play pranks and very fond of outdoor sports. Well, in 1850, Cleveland's dad's like, hey, gang, let's move to Oneida County, New York, because I'm going to work as a district secretary for the American Home Missionary Society. And as you know, if you're working in missions, that type of work doesn't really yield a whole big load of money. That is, if it's not corrupt in some sort of way. But it sounds like the Cleveland family, they were pretty upstanding. And this causes Grover to need to leave his schooling and help out with the family finances. So he does that. And in 1853, this missionary work is taking a huge toll on Cleveland's father's health. So the family moves to Holland Patent, New York, which is near Utica. And after they move, he dies from a gastric ulcer. So Cleveland, Grover Cleveland, he's doing his thing. He's trying to help his family out. And he hears about his father's death, reportedly, from a boy selling newspapers. How tragic is that?
Yeah, definitely. He ended up getting his elementary education at the Fayetteville Academy and the Clinton Liberal Academy. And like Jason said, after his father dies, he again leaves school to help support the family. And later that year, his brother gets hired as a teacher at the New York Institute for the Blind there in New York City. And he's like, hey, Grover, you want to come over here and be my assistant teacher? And Grover says, sure. He goes back home in 1854, and there's an elder at his church who says, if you promise that you'll become a minister in the future, I'll pay for your college education. And Grover Cleveland's like, well, that's really nice of you, but no, I don't want to be a preacher. So he moves west in 1855. He moves all the way west out to Buffalo, New York, and gets a job underneath his uncle, Lewis F. Allen, doing clerical work. So his uncle is a pretty important guy there in Buffalo, and he introduces Grover to a lot of really high-ranking individuals. And some of them are people who are in a law firm. No, there's a little bit of a connection there, right?
Mm-hmm.
He then begins to read law and was admitted to the New York bar in 1859. Incidentally, we've mentioned this a couple other times, or we've mentioned connections like this where people have worked a couple other times. Millard Fillmore, who was the 13th president of the United States, also had worked for that same partnership that he was affiliated with previously in his life as well. So all sorts of connections. Here we are, Grover Cleveland, admitted to the New York bar, just like every good president should do, study law in 1859.
Of course, and if it's in the early 1860s, which it was, when Congress says, hey, you need to serve in the Civil War because you're an able-bodied man. If we come calling for you, you need to do it. Well, you can totally buy your way out of this. And Congress, I know, Congress passes the Conscription Act of 1863. And they're like, yeah, you want to hire a substitute? Go for it. Grover's like, I want to hire George Beninsky, $150. He's a 32-year-old Polish immigrant. Dude, George, here's some cash. Go fight for me. And that's exactly what happens. Cleveland continues his work in law there in Buffalo. So after he is doing a pretty good job of, you know, all that lawyers do, he has several victories. One of them includes a winning defense of a libel suit that was brought against the editor of the Commercial Advertiser, which was the Buffalo newspaper. Grover Cleveland assumes a very simple lifestyle. He takes residence in a boarding house, which is pretty plain, and he decides that he is going to use his income to support his mom as well as his younger sisters. He, in the midst of all of this, enjoys a very active social life. And yet he shuns the circles of high society Buffalo, which his uncle pretty much hung out with.
So from the beginning of his involvement with politics, Grover Cleveland was part of the Democratic Party, and he really did not like the Republicans. He wasn't just like a Democrat because of, oh, these things that benefit me or whatever. He just didn't like Republicans. It also helped that the bosses of the place where he worked, of the firm where he worked, were pretty staunch Democrats. So in 1865, he decides to run for district attorney and loses. Not only loses, but it loses to a friend and someone who was a roommate at one point. He loses, of course, to the Republican nominee. So he makes it through and goes to the election and loses. A little while later, in 1870, he secures the nomination for the Democratic Party for the sheriff of Erie County in New York, not in Pennsylvania. And he does win that election by a 303-vote margin. At age 33, he takes office as the sheriff. And he wasn't any longer really practicing law, but he did make a ton of money. And they said he made what would be equivalent to about $800,000 over those 2 years that he was in office. So I'm not sure if all of that was above board. It seems like a high salary for a sheriff, but nonetheless, that's what he made.
Yeah. Well, oh my goodness, Ben, as the sheriff, you're the one who has the job of executing people at this time. And he does end up hanging a convicted murderer, a guy who actually killed his mom. He had some reservations about, you know, not pulling the trigger, but doing whatever you do when you hang somebody. What is that?
The gallows?
Yeah. Like
pool. Yeah.
Is that you say pool? Pulled the gallows, something like that. Anyway, he could have paid a person to do that, but he did it himself. And he executes another murderer the next year. So he did rise to the occasion there in fulfilling his duties as sheriff. Interestingly enough, though, it was during this time, while he was the sheriff of Buffalo, that he begins a relationship with Maria Crofts Haplin. They were not married, and there is a child born into her home. Was this Grover Cleveland's child? Was Maria Grover Cleveland's mistress? Quite possibly. And that's going to come up when he runs for national office later on.
And it is worth noting that whether it was his child or not, he ended up supporting Maria and the child as well. So that, like Jason said, does come up in a bit, and we'll get into that. The thing, Jason, that I wanted to mention was he was willing to pay someone like $150 to fight for him in the war, but he wasn't willing to pay somebody $10 to hang another person for him while he was making like almost $1 million a year. Well, $1 million our currency a year, which it's just kind of interesting that, you know, he chose one and not the other to me.
Yeah. But then if you're going to pay somebody to do the job, like to pay somebody so you don't have to serve in the Civil War where you might lose your own life, but then.
Sure. I understand. Yeah, I understand the rationale. It's just interesting, especially considering he was like, I'm not 100% sure about this whole executing thing, especially this guy. And then he did it anyway.
I know. Maybe like, I retire. I'm going to move to Canada and
right,
kill salmon instead of people.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, so in the 1870s, the government, the municipal government in Buffalo, is getting more and more and more corrupt, and the political machines are raging, and it's just the whole mess that we hear about so often in the late 1800s with all the corruption. In 1881, Republicans nominate a whole slate of people who are not of the best reputation, and the Democrats are like, okay, look, we can just nominate a candidate that is not dishonest, or at least that no one knows is dishonest, and hopefully we'll win. So they approach Grover Cleveland, and he's like, sure, I'll run for mayor of Buffalo. Why not? And only one condition. Everybody else that's on the ticket, I have to like them too. So there were, of course, some, you know, bad blood on the Democrat / Republican mix there. But since there weren't as many bad dudes on the Democratic ticket, Cleveland accepts the nomination. He was elected mayor and takes office in January of 1882. So while he was mayor, he mostly spent time fighting against the different political machines. And of course, he has his own persuasions during this as well. One of the first things that kind of cements him into place and gets his reputation going is he vetoes a bill that was a street cleaning bill passed by the council. And basically, this contract is open for bids. Council selects the highest bidder rather than the lowest bidder because of the political connections that are there. And Grover Cleveland's like, no, I'm not going to have any of this. Quote, I regard it as the culmination of a most barefaced, impudent, and shameless scheme to betray the interests of the people and to worse than squander the public money, end quote. So the council's like, okay, we get it. And they reverse the decision and award it to somebody else. So at this point, Grover Cleveland kind of gets the impression, or everybody gets the impression of Grover Cleveland, that he's not going to stand for much stuff. And he just starts purging out different people who are corrupt in the government.
Yeah. And in 1882, the state party is taking notice of this mayor who is not just a tool of the machine. And party leaders consider Cleveland as a possible nominee. The Republicans are dealing with their own set of issues in New York, and they are divided largely because of the same thing that's going on with political machines, party bosses, and the whole deal. And what ends up happening is Cleveland emerges as the victor for the election. And this is not just a small victory. This is a couple hundred thousand votes. And this is the largest margin of victory in a contested New York election ever up to that point. And the Democrats also pick up seats in both houses of the state legislature. One of the things that's very evident about Cleveland in the governor's office is that he vetoes certain bills that come across his desk, and one which was a bill that would reduce fares on the New York City elevated trains to 5 cents. And this bill had a lot of support because Jay Good, who owned the trains, he was unpopular and he wanted to raise fares, and this was denounced. But Cleveland saw this bill as being just because Good had actually helped keep the train solvent. And people like Theodore Roosevelt were like, I don't like this bill that's going to punish Good. And Cleveland says, nope, we're going to do this. And Theodore Roosevelt, along with a lot of the legislators, decide that, well, I guess we're going to need to listen to you, Mr. Grover Cleveland. So that's exactly what they do. And this upsets the party bosses, but it really breaks the effect that Tammany Hall and other party bosses held on the government at that time.
In 1884, the Republicans get together in Chicago and they nominate James Blaine, the former Speaker of the House, for president on the fourth ballot. And Blaine, well, a lot of people don't like him. A lot of Republicans especially don't like him because he is immoral and ambitious. And ambitious meaning different than what we think of it now. We think of ambitious as a good thing. Ambitious is more like out for himself and really going full speed ahead. The Mugwumps, if you remember anything about them, were alienated. The Conkling faction was not really feeling the love because of President Arthur just before. So the Democrats are like, okay, they have a really bad setup here. They have a not that great nominee. Their party is split into factions. If we do this right, we can win the White House. So they find Samuel J. Tilden. He's the front runner, and he'd been the nominee in 1876. But Tilden is in poor health, and he declines the nomination, which feels like they probably should have checked with him before they nominated him, or before they tried to nominate him, but they didn't. So some other people start coming up. Grover Cleveland is, of course, among those, as well as Alan Thurman, Samuel Freeman, Thomas Bayard, Benjamin Butler, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So they all have their support and they have their weaknesses. Some of them are in favor of secession, which then the Northerners aren't going to like them. Some of them were popular in the South, which means the Northerners aren't going to like them. And then there's Thurman, who everybody kind of likes, but he's getting older. And that's not necessarily a great thing. Cleveland, Grover Cleveland, has a lot of people who don't like him. But the fact that most of the people who don't like him are corrupt, and people know that, makes him more friendly than others. So Grover Cleveland is leading on the first ballot with 392 votes out of 820. And on the second ballot, Tammany's like, okay, we're throwing all our eggs in the Butler basket, but everybody else shifts to Cleveland, who ends up winning. Thomas A. Hendricks is selected as his vice presidential nominee running mate.
What ends up happening in this election of 1884 is character becomes an extremely important part of who people are going to choose to become president. And Grover Cleveland is seen as the guy with the moral character. He's breaking the political machine. He's emerged as the Democratic nominee. The Democrats desperately need a high character, high moral character to emerge as the nominee. They've got their man. And what do the Republicans do? They say, Ma, where's my paw? They bring up the scandal that we mentioned previously. And Cleveland says, you know what? It's quite possible. It's quite possible that I could be the father of this child. And you know what? I'm going to do everything I can do to tell the truth. He assumes responsibility for the child. He's paying child support. He's supporting Maria. And everything that she says about Grover Cleveland is that he's a moral man and I support him. So what ends up happening is Cleveland wins the swing states. He wins New York by 1,200 votes. So it was close. And after the election, of which Cleveland gets the 219 to 182 electoral votes, his supporters say, Mama, gone to the White House. Ha, ha, ha. So Grover Cleveland, the bachelor, is elected president.
And in the next episode, we'll talk about his first term as president and, of course, everything that comes after as well. But we want you, in the meantime, to let us know what you think about Grover Cleveland. I'm just kidding. We want you to leave a review. You knew that was coming. And we want you to go over to iTunes and leave us a review. And, you know, if you can type up something nice, that'd be great. If you just want to leave a star rating, that's fine, too. Make sure you're subscribed, which we assume most people are at this point, and tell a friend while you're at it.
Yeah, and while you're doing all of this connecting with people and telling them how much you appreciate the podcast, go ahead and give us a shout out on social media. You can find us at Election College on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. We will talk to you next time.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.